Well, it really is great to be here. I hope you don't mind if I walk here. Can you see the screen? This screen's going to be important. Oh, you've got a screen over there. Great. Oh, well, in which case, I'm probably going to stand about here then. Is that about the right place to stand? I'm going to need to turn from time to time. But just to start off where we are. So 27 books in the New Testament, and the two in yellow are the ones which are ascribed to Luke. About 27% of the New Testament ascribed to Luke. And really, in order to be able to look at the reliability of Luke, I'd also want to include the subject of Acts. Now, in giving this talk, I've got a number of different audiences in mind. I know the vast majority of you are believers. There may be a few who aren't Christians here, and you're very welcome. For some of you, you're already convinced that Luke's reliable. Maybe this can be a talk that helps explain how you might explain bits of reliability to people. And there are so many different angles at which reliability can be approached. But part of it, I think, is also looking at evidence from the book of Acts, because the book of Acts travels far more widely than the book of Luke. And so in terms of getting specific correlation with outside history, you get somewhat more in the book of Acts. They're also the two longest books in the New Testament, so I want to look at them together. Volume 1, of course, about Jesus. Volume 2, about the church. And Volume 2 breaks off very suddenly with Paul in prison awaiting the outcome of him being in prison and on trial, and you're not told. And that seems to be around the year 62 when you work the chronology of Paul's life, which you can piece together from both the book of Acts and from Paul's letters. And many would argue that because you're not told the outcome, but you would really rather like to know the outcome, that it's not a bad argument saying that Volume 2 was completed around the year 62. Therefore, Volume 1, Luke's Gospel, was done before that. Now, you could get around that argument if you want to say, no, the point of Acts is not to get us to Paul being in prison, but actually to show how the gospel has gone to the end of the world. Rome is the end of the world. It's really achieved. But I still am inclined to think that Acts is written around the year 62, shortly after that, and therefore Luke somewhat earlier. There's a unified Greek style across those two works, which means that, you know, what you can say about one, you really ought to be able to say about the author of the other. Now, one argument you could use for saying Luke really did write this is Luke would be nobody if it weren't for the gospel. I mean, he's one of these people who's just mentioned a few times in the New Testament, but he would be, I'm not saying Epaphroditus was a nobody, that's not fair, but there are sort of people that you haven't heard of very much, you know, not very high profile in the New Testament. That's exactly what Luke would be. He'd be a name in a list if it weren't for the gospel. So what motive would anyone have for attributing it to him, particularly since he doesn't claim to be an eyewitness and no one claims he's an eyewitness? So there isn't really a motive. It's a bit like with the Gospel of Mark. So with Matthew and John, which are said to be by eyewitnesses, I believe they are by eyewitnesses, they are disciples of Jesus, you can see a motive why someone would say, this is by Matthew, this is by John. But why you would do that with Mark, who's not an eyewitness, why you'd do that with Luke, is harder to say. And he seems most probably to be a Gentile, so the only Gentile writer in the New Testament. Paul mentions him thrice. We've got him there in a list in Philemon. We've got him at the end of his life, 2 Timothy, only Luke is with me. And of course, in Colossians 4:14, we have our dear friend Luke, the doctor, and Demas sends greetings. And him being a doctor, there weren't any philosophical doctors then, so doctor meant you were actually useful, is that the striking thing is there's quite a bit of medical language. And there's a book which is from 1882, which is all about St. Luke's medical language. So Hobart, the medical language of St. Luke, a proof from internal evidence that the gospel according to St. Luke and the Acts of the Apostles were written by the same person and that writer was a medical man. Well, that's a lovely old-fashioned title, and you might want to have a look at that book, which I think is quite interesting because it does line up a number of different terms with medical terms. So, I mean, you all know the Christmas story, or almost all know the Christmas story and how the baby is put in swaddling clothes. Well, why not just look that up as a medical term? That's, you know, and so on. It's not just that, but he actually claims there are 400 of these terms, which, when you give the length of Luke, is quite an occurrence. Now, some of this work has been debated, of course. It's been around for long enough to be debated. And there's back and forth. And it's, you know, he may slightly overstate his case, but there's still something there which can be looked at. So, another reference just about Luke would be something called the Muratorian Canon. This is a list, an early list of New Testament books from usually dated around the year 170. The date isn't absolutely certain, but it's widely accepted, which says the third book of the Gospel is that according to Luke, after the ascension of Christ, Luke, the well-known physician, whom Paul had taken with him as one zealous for the law, composed in his own name according to the general belief. Yet he himself had not seen the Lord in the flesh, and therefore, as he was able to ascertain events, so indeed he begins to tell the story from the birth of John the Baptist. So there you have, again, it's not that this is by an eyewitness. So I think that gives you reason to trust the ascription of authorship. But then when we look at how the gospel begins, these very well-known words that you have in front of you, and you may want to turn open to them, what we see is that it begins in a very particular way. The first four verses are like a prologue. The moment you get to verse 5 of chapter 1, you get into a very different mould. You get into a story that sounds a bit like you're in the Old Testament, almost as if you're reading 1 Samuel. You've got this barren couple. And what you'd have in the days of Herod the king, there was so-and-so, and they were both righteous. And it sounds a bit like an Old Testament narrative. But the first four verses go like this. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. So this is what Luke says about his own writing, and you will see that it's dedicated to a man called Theophilus. Read the beginning of Acts, and it's also dedicated to Theophilus. But we can also say a certain amount about Theophilus. We don't know Theophilus from outside the New Testament, but he is called most excellent. Kratistos is the Greek word, which is the same title, it's an official title, which is given to both Festus and Felix. You remember the governors you come across in the book of Acts. So very high-ranking people. And so in order to be able to address someone like this, they have to be pretty high-ranking. And it also means you can't really make them up. I mean, you can't just make up a figure, because everyone will know that there isn't a high-ranking figure of that nature. And so the fact that you have this addressee is an interesting thing. And he's not claiming to be an eyewitness, but he's checked it out from the beginning. He's been following this story for a long time. He says many other people have also written accounts. He doesn't necessarily criticize those accounts. Therefore, by the way, many isn't just Matthew and Mark. Many different stories. And therefore, I would have no problem if someone found a really, really early gospel that's earlier than Luke. That wouldn't mean I had to put it into my Bible, because in order to be in the Bible, it doesn't just have to be early. It has to be early and demonstrably intended by God to be given for his church for all ages. And that's a slightly higher criterion. But what we can say is that he seems to have taken a lot of care. The style of this, when he talks about how he's done this carefully, is the sort of style that is widely thought to belong to a technical treatise. Now, a technical treatise could be a medical work, or it could be a work of history, but there's a certain style of quite elaborate prologue that people wrote for this. So you can look at the work of Loveday Alexander to follow up some of the details on this particular genre of opening. So it's writing as a technical treatise. In other words, it's saying this is not fiction. As for the addressee, well, it's a high-ranking official, and Theophilus would have had to have known the author. Now, some people claim that the four Gospels are anonymous, because in the text of the Gospels, it doesn't have the word Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. That's sort of true, but it's not very helpful. Because in those days, when you had all sorts of books in bookshops, even if they don't have the book on the in the body of the text, they'd still have a label on the scroll in order to tell you whose book it was. So the idea that there were anonymous books is difficult. This is a book by someone to a known addressee, therefore the person who's written it is known. And right the way through the early manuscripts, we have a unity of running header, across the top of the manuscripts. We'll see, according to Luke, according to John, and so on, in each of the Gospels. So in other words, the name has been associated from the very beginning. Theophilus may even have been Luke's literary patron, who, sponsored people to copy this early on. Now, what I'd want to say is, when we then look at the book of Acts, we see the actions of this man Luke described, because there are we passages in Acts where he said, we did this, and it picks up really the second half of the book of Acts. Certain passages where he is travelling with Paul, and that's happening in the 50s AD, whatever precise year we put it, it's somewhere around there. Now, if that is when he's like active in his career but has already been a physician, we don't want to put the composition, the writing of the gospel, really late on in the first century, because he's probably not going to be alive. So in other words, he's someone who's active at a time really quite close to the events. If Christ died either the year 30 or the year 33, which are the two commonly dated taken years for the crucifixion, we're talking about something that's not written a very long time afterwards. And if someone wants to say, well, I don't believe Luke wrote that, someone else wrote it, there is an economic objection, and that is the details we're going to see that he has of his travels across the Mediterranean in the book of Acts would be the sort of details you couldn't get by looking up information in a bookshop. They just didn't have the bookshops that would give you that sort of information, and, you know, no Wikipedia back then and so on. Actually, to do the historical research, to write a fictional novel that looked like the Book of Acts, would be a really expensive thing. You'd have to go around travelling to Malta and, to Turkey and all sorts of places in order to get the details, in order to write your fictional novel. So if you don't have a travelling companion of Paul actually doing it, you have to have someone a few decades later paying in order to do the research, in order to write a fictional story. You know, it just becomes implausible. So I'm not saying, and I don't think you should try and argue that you can prove this to be true. That's really a fruitless thing to do. What you just need to show is that this is very believable, it's reasonable to believe it, and that anyone who wants to come up with an alternative is often doing a lot more work. It's something much more unreasonable. So it's not about proving, because, you know, someone will sometimes say, prove to me this text is true, and you can't. You can't prove anything outside of mathematics and formal logic, and they are not about real life. You know, no disrespect. They're abstract games, and that's fine, with games with much application. So what I want us to do is look at a network of arguments tonight for the reliability. And in each one of these categories, and I've divided into five different categories, there are subcategories. And what I'd want to hopefully convey to you is how you would be able to present a number of different sorts of argument for the reliability of the text. So firstly, we're going to look at the detailed knowledge of time and space and culture that the author has. Secondly, the hallmarks of a teacher, namely Jesus, that there really is a character behind the teaching. I want to look at the subject of corroboration of a couple of different things, and things that would be hard to invent, and then finally the reliability of the text, the actual manuscript. So let's go through into the first category there. By the way, hopefully at the end of this talk, someone will come with a pen drive and take all of these, and they can be used for, you know, private study if you need to, in case you're worried that you won't manage to get it all down. Let's start with some technical details. One of the things we see in the book of Acts is how the right titles are given to officials. I mean, as Paul goes around and travels to in different places, he meets different officials. And these people have exactly the right local name. So, for instance, the people who are interacting with Paul in Acts 17 are called politarchs. Now, that's a word that only occurs 19 times in the attested Greek corpus outside the New Testament, and most of it is not in classical authors, it's in inscriptions. And those inscriptions come from Macedonia, which is where Thessalonica is, and most of them come from Thessalonica itself. In other words, it's probably not a word that if you just lived in Egypt, you would even know existed, and yet it's exactly the right word for that place. Or you could look at when you get to Ephesus and you're in chapter 19 of Acts, you have the Asiarchs. And again, that's exactly the right name for time and place. Or when you get to Malta and Paul's been shipwrecked on Malta, and who's ill? Publius. And he's called the leading man of the island, or literally the first of the island. Well, there is an inscription which shows from up from the book from Malta, which talks about the first of the island. That is exactly the right title. If you want more details on this argument, I would send you either to F.F. Bruce's commentary on the Book of Acts, all his book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable?, which is a very old book, but very worthwhile. He says of this, this is F.F. Bruce, "The accuracy of Luke's use of the various titles in the Roman Empire has been compared to the easy and confident way in which an Oxford man, in ordinary conversation, will refer to the heads of Oxford colleges by their proper titles, the Provost of Oriel, the Master Balliol, the Rector of Exeter, the President of Magdalen, and so on. The sort of thing that a local can do effortlessly, but actually, if you haven't been there, it's really very difficult. Another feature we see in terms of knowledge is the synchronisms, and the most striking synchronism is there at the beginning of chapter 3. This is how John the Baptist's ministry is introduced. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of the Lord came to John the son of Zechariah in the wilderness. Now, that's a really striking big deal. But you can find the same sorts of synchronism, establishing the exact time in Thucydides, you know, the Greek author. In other words, there's a style that you write in order to show the exact time. This is the most elaborate one that he has, and it basically works exactly. Now, people don't always use these synchronisms so much, because the beginning of chapter 2, there's one that's somewhat more difficult. More famous, we have this, Luke chapter 2, first few verses. "In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This is the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria." Now, there's a difficulty there, in that the normal date when Quirinius is thought to be governor is the year 6 AD, and yet it's normally thought that Herod the Great died around BC 4, that's the classical, you know, the standard date for when he died. And so if Jesus was born before Herod died, then Jesus is born before the year 4. Going on with this? It's a really complex matter. You can go into, if you want all the gory details, go to Darrell Bock's commentary on Luke, and there are 20 pages on it and all sorts of interesting details in there. But this is, if you like, I think the biggest chronological problem in the New Testament. Now, I just lay it out there because, to me, that makes me really relaxed. Because all the problem is this. Josephus, a historian slightly later than Luke, says one thing and Luke says another thing. Well, if it's just a head-to-head, why do I have to follow Josephus and not Luke? So, in other words, even the worst problem is not exactly a defeater, it's just a problem. There may be even reconciliations. So that's as bad as it gets, and I'm quite laid back about that. Some people say, but aren't there all sorts of problems with, you know, this decree? Do we have evidence for it? Let's put it this way. If you were a Roman emperor, what would you want? You would want taxes, would you not? I mean, so I just find explaining to people that, you know, Romans were quite interested in taxing people because it is, you know, what's the point of being an emperor if you can't actually benefit? You know, and you can't actually tax people without knowing how many people there are. It's a fairly basic thing. So the idea that people weren't doing censuses, I think, is a bit strange. When we look at the book of Acts, we find an interesting feature with the way chronology is treated. That is, apart from the very beginning of Acts, where we have a bit more detail about the 40 days during which Jesus appeared, then the 50 days after his resurrection when you have Pentecost, and the sort of clue is in the name because Pentecost means 50. If you then go from there, Acts chapter 2, through to Acts chapter 9, you really don't know how long it takes. How many years after the resurrection, or, you know, was Paul converted? We don't know. Was it 1, 2, 3, 4? I don't know. You can ask an expert, but they're just making up a number, you see? So the chronology is really quite vague early on in the book of Acts. But then, when we find that Luke is the travelling companion, and it's in a we section saying, we did this, we did that, he says, you know, they did this for 3 Sabbath days, or for 3 months, or they stayed 5 days here. Or look at this at chapter 28. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, the ship of Alexandria, with the twin gods as its figurehead. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days, and from there we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium, and after one day a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Puteoli. Now, the thing about that is, how do you know the travelling times if you're just making up a story sitting in an armchair? To be able to get this sort of thing, you really have to do the journey or speak to someone who's done the journey. So it's not trivial information. And yet that's the sort of way we find the book of Acts is working, and I think that's a sign for the way Luke works. He's not going to make up chronology when he doesn't know it. Now, when we look at geographical knowledge, there's all sorts of bits of geographical knowledge. And I would just say, throw the Bible, the book of Luke, open with the people you're doing a Bible study with, and you will see geographical details almost everywhere. So just the fact that in Luke chapter 2, the famous Christmas story, the writer knows that there are shepherds out in fields keeping sheep near Bethlehem is a piece of accurate geographical knowledge. There's a long history of knowledge of people keeping sheep near Bethlehem. Now, you could say, of course, he got it from the Old Testament, but even then, you might know that back in the days of David, they kept sheep there. How would you know that happened actually in the first century unless you'd actually been there, spoken to someone who had, or something like that? Or when you look at the storms that arise on the Sea of Galilee, it's really strange that rain isn't mentioned. You know, if we were making up storms, we would have wind and rain. But what you see with the storms they have on the Sea of Galilee is that they are sudden windstorms. Now, of course, when you think about the Jordan Rift Valley, you know, deep valley, sudden wind is one of those phenomena that you really do get there. And that's exactly what is reported in the Gospel. So that sort of detail is the sort of thing you would expect. So just train yourself as you read through the book of Luke to see these things and see how actually they are implying something about the knowledge of the author, which is of a non-trivial kind. That does not mean, of course, the stories, miraculous stories that the author writes have to be true or can be proven to be true, but it does show that the author has some close-up familiarity. You could find in Jesus' story that a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho knowing that, you know, the land actually goes down. I mean, it's trivial for us. We can look it up on Google. But back for them, then it was not so easy if you were living far away. Or the story of Zacchaeus, where he's a chief tax collector in Jericho, which is exactly on the trade route or the route you'd take down from Galilee, you go down the Jordan Valley, cross at Jericho and then up to Jerusalem. A really good place to have a big tax collecting thing. So think of if you're talking to people who are into finance, explaining the financial arguments, because there are many, many financial arguments for the reliability of the Gospels, you know, and probably make sense to them. So chief tax collector, he's got exactly the right sort of name for a first century person, and he climbs up a sycamore tree. Well, those are non-trivial pieces of information. Even the species of tree, this is a really reliable source here, Wikipedia, but there is an article actually on the ancient distribution of Ficus sycamoris, and you can show basically the same thing applies, that people in Turkey, Greece, Italy wouldn't have even heard of this particular tree. So, you know, someone in those lands wouldn't be making up a story like that. When we look at Paul's travels in the book of Acts, they really are dazzling. I mean, three missionary journeys plus the voyage to Rome. And so we start with the blue journey, and then we go pink, red, and finally green. And so you can see here that you've got inland Turkey, you've got coastal Turkey, you've got islands, you've got Greece, you're going over to Malta, you've got an amazing sea journey, which is probably the most detailed ancient sea voyage to be described. In terms of nautical terms, Acts chapter 27, it's a phenomenally detailed thing, and I find it very difficult to imagine anyone being able to write that who hasn't really spent quite a bit of time on a ship. But you also have Cyprus, you have all that, and you have the right governors and the right people in. That's the sort of knowledge that our author is displaying, and that's a rather striking thing. Now, bring it home to Luke's Gospel, and of course, Luke's Gospel has many towns that are mentioned, about 14 towns that are mentioned, as well as other... Is that 14? Yeah, it is, yeah. As well as other places that aren't towns. Now, some of these are easy for it to get, like, let's say, Jerusalem was a fairly well-known place. But Bethphage, Bethsaida to some extent, Bethany, less well-known, Arimathea, and Emmaus, Chorazin. These are all less well-known towns. Again, if you're in a bookshop in Rome, you're not going to be able to find out about these. And so it's not trivial that it knows this sort of information. And you can compare that with some of the apocryphal Gospels. So the four Gospels have 12 to 14 towns each, a total of 23 different towns mentioned. The best town-mentioning apocryphal Gospel has just two towns, which is the Gospel of Philip, which mentions Jerusalem and Nazareth. It happens to think that Nazareth is Jesus' middle name, which is not very impressive. And Jerusalem is the capital, so that's not exactly rocket science. Then look at some other apocryphal Gospels. Gospel of Peter and the Saviour, they've just got one town each, and that is Jerusalem, which is, again, the capital, and therefore not very clever to know. And the next earliest 13 apocryphal Gospels have no towns at all. So in terms of just giving you a control sample, that what we're finding in a writing like Luke is we're finding really solid geographical knowledge, and we're finding in the other writings they just don't have that. Now let's just look at the four Gospels and the number of words we have in each Gospel. I've got four left-hand columns there, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And I've given you five apocryphal Gospels on the right, which are Philip, Thomas, Judas, Peter and Mary. I just want you to fix your eyes on those four left-hand columns for a moment. I'm going to change slides to the number of place names per Gospel. This is not towns, this is places, like Golgotha is a place as well as not a town. So that's the number of words, that's the number of places. That's the number of words, that's the number of places. Okay? That's the number of words, that's the number of places. You get the idea? So when I say give me places as a proportion of length, apart from Peter, who's really short and therefore a bit of a statistical anomaly, we find that all four Gospels have five place names per thousand words. Now this is an amazing thing. Because they're basically averaging. Whatever length they are, they have the same average number of place names. Now, to say that this was put in deliberate is rather difficult, because counting words, when in Greek manuscripts people don't even divide them, and counting place names, when in Greek manuscripts they don't even write capital letters, or they don't even write small letters, or whichever way you think of it, they don't distinguish. You know, it's not easy to look at a page and just say, oh, those are the place names. Getting that sort of averaging, it would be phenomenally difficult if you tried. How do you achieve this pattern? This is how you achieve it. By not trying. At least, you know, if you're not trying, but you're simply all writing the same genre, you might end up having the same frequency. If someone's trying too hard to put in a place name to make the story sound authentic, that sort of artificial action is not going to produce this. We can also say that there are specific times when the names that Luke mentioned makes sense. So in the feeding of the 5,000, which is in all four Gospels, in John's Gospel, Jesus turns to this man called Philip and says, where should he buy bread? And then Andrew and Philip get involved in a reply. Now, when you're reading through John's Gospel, you see no significance to why he turns to those particular disciples. When you look in Luke's Gospel, Luke tells you, and he's the only writer who tells you, that this took place near Bethsaida. And when I look at the beginning of John's Gospel, I find out that Philip and Andrew were from Bethsaida. So if I'm reading through John's Gospel, I see no significance whatsoever to why he asked these particular disciples where to buy bread from. If I plug in the information from Luke, suddenly it makes sense. So you've got a dovetailing, a corroboration which is going on there, which makes sense if, you know, they're not trying, they're just, you know, telling the truth. So if you like, I'm trying to combine a couple of he's not trying hard arguments. And if you want to make the opposite argument, you probably have to make he tried a very hard argument. You know, that's the thing, it would be a whole load of effort to dovetail in that way, because a lot of people wouldn't even notice that. I imagine some of you probably haven't noticed that. Let's look now at hallmarks of a teacher. What you would find is, if Luke is correctly reporting about Jesus, we would expect there to be some features of his style. So Socrates has his particular style. Most teachers have a particular style. Can we see a style with Jesus? Well, I'd want to look at a few different aspects of style. One is the special expressions and literary forms associated with Jesus. Secondly, embarrassing teachings. And thirdly, what I just call loosely genius. If you can think of a better word for it, that's fine. But firstly in teaching and secondly in stories. So let's look at special expressions. One of the things we find is that the way Jesus teaches is different from the way later Christians taught. So you can make a fairly obvious argument like this. Wouldn't it have been really great to have Jesus teach about what you should do in a church service? But he doesn't. Wouldn't it have been really great to have him teach on what you should do about all those Gentiles? But he doesn't. In other words, he's not teaching on the sorts of things that if you were wanting to put things into his mouth to solve the problems that you have later, he's not teaching on those subjects. He's actually teaching in a way which is very distinctive. So he also teaches in parables. Now, this is a striking thing we're just going to have a look at in a moment. And when he refers to himself, he doesn't refer to himself as the Son of God. He doesn't refer to himself as the Christ most of the time. He refers to himself as the Son of Man. Now, what's so striking about that is that the Son of Man is hardly ever used as an expression by early Christians outside of referring to Jesus when Jesus himself is speaking. So in other words, it's not the sort of way that the apostles went round evangelizing saying, I'm going to tell you about the Son of Man. They didn't. But we find that this is a way Jesus talks about himself. If we look at the distribution of the Son of Man as an expression, we find it a lot in the four Gospels. We find it sometimes very absent in some of the apocryphal Gospels. Q, I just put there, is not a Gospel, but it's a scholarly hypothesis. The way many scholars think that Luke originated is like this. You've got Mark's Gospel, and you've got a source, which is the common material you've got in Matthew and Luke. And they just call Q, because Q is German. Well, the German word for source begins with Q. And so that's a scholarly idea that Matthew and Luke both use Mark and Q. And Q uses the Son of Man a certain amount. But it's not just that when Luke is mentioning the Son of Man, it comes from either Mark or Q. It actually, there's many bits that are exclusive to Luke that have all sorts of mention of the Son of Man. So it's not that he's copying any of these patterns from elsewhere. When we look at parables, one of the things that's striking is that there is no widespread use of parables at the time of Jesus. In the Old Testament, there are probably only a couple of parables, and they're in the book of 2 Samuel. You might find a few more that you define as parables, but very, very few. In the Apocrypha, there are none. The Dead Sea Scrolls, there are none. In rabbinic literature, and early church, there are very few. In the rabbinic literature, which is about this long when printed on a shelf, there's about 2,000. But those are 2,000 spread out between a whole load of rabbis. So in other words, each rabbi might have one parable that they told. So the idea that one person had a whole load of parables that he told is a very striking feature which is attributed to Jesus. So I'd want to argue the most natural reading is that they were distinctive, a feature of Jesus' actual teaching. Particularly, as you sometimes find, there are themes that go into parables, like many of the parables are about the Son of Man. That's an expression which Jesus uses that later Christians rarely use. So you've got two interlocking special features, which again looks more like a hallmark of a particular person. So we could use that as part of an argument for the reliability of that, and we might look at that a little bit more. Also in terms of embarrassing sayings. I mean, things that if you were wanting to make your own Jesus and when you wrote your gospel, you probably wouldn't put in Luke 14:26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. You probably wouldn't have him tell people to imitate an unfair steward to have to rebuke the lead disciples for the fact they're sleeping and not praying and so on. These are embarrassing things. And you get many of that sort. In terms of what I would call genius, I don't read Chinese, it just looked pretty. But one of the things that Confucius is said to have said is, what you do not want yourself, do not force onto others. Or some people say it should be translated, what you do not want to do yourself, do not force others to do. And that's what's sometimes called a negative golden rule. It's Rabbi Hillel said, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. That's the whole law. Jesus said, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Now, what's striking there is that it's not that what Jesus says is entirely original. It's not that he's the only person who's managed to encapsulate a teaching like that. But if you were to look at the three forms and you were to ask them, strip the names off and just go out into the street and ask which people thought was the most powerful ethic, and you could ask all sorts of secular folk, they would probably come up with the third one. And to me, it's very striking. Now, can I prove that Jesus actually said it? No. But think about the option where he doesn't say it. Jesus isn't a genius. He just is really lucky to have genius disciples who are prepared to come up with great ideas and attribute them to him. Now, isn't that just somewhat ridiculous, you know, that they would give away their intellectual property, give away all of the credit for their great ideas? I mean, so for me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a more strained explanation to say that Jesus didn't actually teach these amazing things, but he, straight after him, there were these really
you know, insightful disciples who came up at the same time as they were lying through their teeth, they come up with these amazing ethics. I don't think it makes an awful lot of sense. So the most natural, the most parsimonious, the most simple explanation is that Jesus actually said these things. We could look at it in stories. I mean, the parable of the Good Samaritan, rich man, Lazarus, prodigal son, persistent widow. I mean, if Jesus didn't say this, who did? You have to make Luke or the storyteller who comes after Jesus the genius. You have to have a genius somewhere. Because when I look at the parable of the prodigal son, and I would love to spend half an hour going through the parable of the prodigal son with you, but I will not. Because one of the things that people don't often notice with that is how every single word in that is really carefully chosen. It's a most carefully crafted story. Everything from the way three times the younger brother calls his father father, and every time the older brother doesn't. And these sort of little details that you find there's a genius in it, and who actually came up with that? Well, I think it's far less natural to have a generation after Jesus coming up with that. So, and that also combines the argument of genius and literary form. So I hope this is a simple enough argument that you would feel you can use that yourself. It's not requiring you to have, you know, great study in theology. It's really a simple argument because, let's face it, I think God has written Scripture in such a way that the arguments for its truth are very democratically accessible. You know, there are some really tough and complicated arguments for its truth. But because God isn't, God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble, and God catches the wise in their craftiness, the thought that he would write Scripture so that the best arguments are only available to those who are, you know, some elite researchers, and there aren't really good arguments there for, you know, ordinary people, just doesn't seem to fit his character. The subject of corroboration, look at a couple of things here. firstly, a bit of historical corroboration. John the Baptist is, of course, mentioned in all four Gospels, and he's a figure that's also mentioned in Josephus. This is what Josephus, I'll start with Luke. Luke says, so with many exhortations, he, that's John the Baptist, preached good news to the people, but Herod the Tetrarch, who had been reproved by him for Herodias, his brother's wife, and for all the evil things that Herod had done, added to this to them all, that he locked John up in prison, and later, of course, he executed him in Luke's Gospel as well. Now, what does Josephus say? Josephus, slightly long passage, says this. Now, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army, the same Herod, came from God as a just punishment for what he had done to John, who was called the Baptist. So you've got confirmation of an individual called John the Baptist. For Herod killed him, though he was a good man, and commanded the Jews to practice virtue, showing righteousness towards one another and piety towards God, and to come together for baptism. The baptism would be acceptable to him, to God, if they were not using it to put away sins, but for the purification of the body when the soul had already been purified beforehand by righteousness. Now, that's quite profound. What it's saying is, repent first and then be baptized. I mean, that's the order you get there, that you've already been purified by righteousness and then you get the bodily stuff. You know, so it's that same order you find in the Gospels. Now, when others came crowding round, for they were very pleased by hearing his words, Herod was afraid that the great influence that John had over the people might lead to rebellion, since they seemed ready to do whatever he advised. He thought it far better to take him and kill him before any trouble came from him than to have regrets if trouble arose. So, through Herod's suspicion, he was sent as a prisoner to Machaerus, the aforementioned castle, and was killed there. Now, what we find is that there's a similarity between what you find in Luke and the Gospels, Matthew and Mark, and Josephus. You've got preaching, you've got lots of crowds coming, you've got an imprisonment and then an execution. You've got the same person responsible for the execution, and you've got a lot of authoritative teaching and similar comments about baptism. But we can also say that there's a little bit more going on here under the surface. That is, Josephus enigmatically begins that people, Jews, thought that the destruction of Herod's army came because he had killed John the Baptist. Now, why on earth would anyone conclude that? And he simply doesn't explain. He doesn't explain why anyone would make a connection between the destruction of Herod's army and killing John the Baptist. But when we dig down, we find out, according to Josephus, that Herod had married and then divorced Phasaelis, the daughter of Aretas the Fourth. Now, Aretas is mentioned in 2 Corinthians at the end, who was king of the Nabataeans nearby. And then he had married Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. That's the picture we get together from Josephus. Now, plug that together with what you find in Luke and elsewhere, where John the Baptist condemns the marriage to Herodias, and then Herod imprisons him because of that, and then later executes him. In other words, you find the same, the two stories actually interlock, they dovetail with each other, that you suddenly understand that it was a deeply political thing for John the Baptist to say to Herod, you shouldn't be marrying her, you know, your brother Philip's wife, she is still your brother Philip's wife. And of course, that is connected after he's jilted the daughter of the king who's just defeated it, who goes on to defeat him. So in other words, you could see exactly why someone would make that connection. So if you like, there's some corroboration within the Gospel, within Josephus, of what you find within the Gospel. You could find corroboration of character. Mary and Martha are fairly well-known figures. I mean, Martha was, you know, quite a stressed-out sort of figure, very efficient. You would want her running your lunch event. Mary was a bit more dippy, is the way one tends to imagine her. At least this is what you get. When you read Luke's Gospel, you probably know the story well. As they went on their way, Jesus entered a village. A woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she and her sister had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went up to him and said, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her to help me. But the Lord answered, Martha, Martha, you're anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen a good portion, which will not be taken away from her. Now, what is so striking is that this is the only gospel in which this incident is told. But when I flip over to John's gospel, I find Jesus going to the house of Mary and Martha when their brother Lazarus has died. And what happens? Martha is the action woman. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went up and met him. But Mary remains seated. Have you seen her seated before? Yes, she was seated in Luke. So if you like, in these sort of little character nuggets, you get the same sort of pattern. Now, does this prove it to be true? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But when you start seeing so many different types of argument interlocking, you start saying, don't we have a web of plausibility where it starts just becoming the simplest thing to believe that it really is true? So that's what I mean by corroboration of character. There seems to be the hallmark of particular people. Things that are hard to invent. There are various things we could mention here. So we could think about the hard reporting, whether it's how the disciples misunderstand, Jesus driving people out of the temple, disciples arguing as to who's the greatest, as per usual, Peter denying Jesus, and so on. Those sorts of things, why would people invent them? You could apply these same arguments to the other Gospels as well. Something that's even harder to invent, though, is the way, when you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they have disagreement in wordings, or difference in wordings, more outside of speech marks than in. And it doesn't matter who is speaking. So when you look at the level of verbal agreement, here we've got Mark's account of the forgiving, you know, the man being let through the roof and so on. Now, in the first section, we're basically at narrative. That's the first seven verses of Mark 2. Then we go on the next four verses where Jesus is speaking. 62 of the words are words of Jesus, and you find a far higher level of agreement between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then when it's the end and it's not Jesus speaking, you find less agreement. That is not just something that happens in sections that can be where Matthew and Luke could be said to be copying Mark, if that's what indeed happened. It's not just what happens where you have sections that belong to the hypothetical Q document. It also happens in resurrection accounts, where you get that same sort of greater level of agreement in words spoken than elsewhere. And that's a feature, and it doesn't matter, it's not just Jesus, it's also when John the Baptist is speaking. That is the sort of feature that happens when, of course, people are simply reporting people's words correctly, not that they're, you know, not just making things up. Of course, when they're reporting a story, they have freedom as to the way in which they word things. They have some freedom in the way in which they quote, because the rules that we have now imposed on quotation haven't yet been invented. That is, we've just introduced speech marks in the last 400 years in our language, and of course they've only come into our Bibles in the last 100 years, and many languages have Bibles which still don't have speech marks. One of the things that speech marks do is they create two new rules about quotation. One is you're not allowed to miss anything out without saying, and two is you're not allowed to put anything in without saying. But before then, quotation wasn't quite like that. So the Gospels are accurate within the categories of their own time. Let's not judge them because they don't fit with our new silly conventions. Patterns of referring to Jesus is another way we could say that the Gospels have got a striking thing that's hard to invent. You see, Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, and in the narrative he's generally referred to as Jesus. But characters in the narrative don't refer to him as Jesus because Jesus was a really common name. It was the sixth most common name at the time, so you couldn't just say Jesus is coming down the street because people would say, which Jesus is coming down the street? So in fact, you find the characters in Luke don't just say, what do we have to do with you, Jesus? They say, what do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus, Son of the Most High God, Jesus, Teacher. I like this one in Luke 18. Here we got Jesus with an extra bit outside of speech. They told him Jesus the Nazarene was passing by. But even as they have that extra bit, Jesus the Nazarene, not rather than just plain Jesus, that is, of course, reporting the content of speech. So it actually gives you the very phrase that was used. Then he calls out Jesus, Son of David. The one place in Luke where you don't have Jesus plus a disambiguator is in the personal address to Jesus by a thief on a cross, where, of course, there's no need to disambiguate. But, you know, the angel, when Jesus appears to the couple on the road to Emmaus, and he says, haven't you heard the things going on? They say, haven't you heard the things going on? He said, what things? They said, well, the things concerning Jesus of Nazareth. In other words, back at the period when Luke is writing, he disambiguates the name Jesus just as it would need to be disambiguated at an early stage, but not after Christianity had been spreading for quite a number of decades. The reliability of the text, let's look at this. I want to introduce you to a manuscript called P75. P numbers go up to about 130 so far, which are papyrus. P stands for papyrus. And papyrus really goes extinct in Egypt about the year 700, roughly. So anything written on papyrus is before then. And this is a nice manuscript which was in Geneva until they flogged it off and the Vatican bought it recently, but it's dated around the year 225, and here it is. And what I like about this is it has the end of Luke's Gospel and the beginning of John's Gospel, and this is from 100 years before Constantine had his great council in Nicaea. So any idea that, you know, Constantine was the guy who chose the Gospels is problematic, not just because of this manuscript, but also because of another manuscript in Dublin, which comes from southern Egypt, from around the same year, which has the four Gospels and the Book of Acts. It's problematic for other reasons, because there are other people using the four Gospels in places like France and Syria well before Constantine. And so this is the one of the earliest extensive manuscripts of Luke. So there are fragments from earlier than this, but I'm going to lay that now alongside our earliest complete copy of Luke, which is the Codex Vaticanus from the 4th century. Now, what's interesting is we've got our earliest extensive but not complete, because it doesn't have anything from before chapter 3, and I've got Vaticanus here. Now, what I thought I'd do is just actually show you the Greek text from these. So here's John's Gospel, and this is the end of Luke, okay? This is the end of Luke, this is John. Now, let's blow that up. I couldn't get a really good quality image of Vaticanus because it's in the Vatican, they're sitting on it. But you can see here, Gospel according to Luke. Some of you will be able to see L-O-U-K-A-N, Lucan. Maybe you can't, but it is there, honest. Now, what I thought I'd do is actually lay out what this says. So I'll just translate it for you. So it happened as he was blessing them. He departed from them, was carried up into heaven, and they worshipped him, and they returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and they were continuing in the temple praising God. Now, what I've done is I've highlighted in orange any differences between those two manuscripts. Now, this manuscript was from Egypt. This manuscript was in Rome. So they're the two earliest manuscripts that just by happenstance happen to survive. There's no reason to think that these two manuscripts are closely connected, that they came from the same area, the same scriptorium where people copied or anything like that. So they're different. They come from very different genealogies. And what we find is an amazing thing. Now, at this point, I can't read the letters at the top right. So I just give you a few dots. But other than those few dots, it's identical. If you look at it to... if we start there, you will see it's the same words, sometimes spread on different lines, okay? Now, this is the word "and," and this manuscript has an abbreviation of the word "and." Big deal. This manuscript has a letter N. This manuscript has an abbreviation of the letter N. This manuscript has a shortening of Jerusalem, I-L-E-M. This one writes it out in full. Big deal. This word, this manuscript, let's go back to it. You see that word written in the margin? That is written by the same hand as wrote this. They omitted a word, and they put an insertion sign and then stuck it in the margin. So if you stick that word in, it's exactly the same as the other one. And all you've got, in terms of the whole difference, is that one of them ends the book with Amen and the other doesn't. That's the only difference you have between these two things. So you can actually map them out. So P75 and Codex Vaticanus, you can show together a huge similarity. Now, that's been mapped out by a guy called Carlo Martini, who was at one stage tipped to be the next pope. He didn't, but he was a great Catholic scholar who actually compared these two manuscripts, and he lists all the differences. There aren't that many. And one of the things it shows is that for, you know, the 100 years between then, and also a lot earlier, because if you think of them as sort of like cousins that are really similar, you can actually say this is showing you a real reliability in the exact copying of very letters. And so I could have shown you more of that. And to me, that... the problem about the idea that people corrupted and changed the text, well, there are many problems. One of them is economic. If you're writing on leather, every few pages that you make up, it's a new animal you've got to have killed. I mean, just think about, you know, the price of a cow, you know, what is it, 100 days' wages, how many, you know, sheets am I going to get from a cow? And you start working it out, and it starts becoming a very expensive business to falsify a manuscript. So the idea that people falsify manuscripts on a large scale just isn't really plausible. Now, the Bibles we have are put together from manuscripts that come from all over the place, inside the Roman Empire, outside the Roman Empire, in, you know, there are different languages. There's no one group controlling it. There's never been a person in all of history, no pope, no Roman emperor, in a position to change everyone's Bibles. And then a final argument, which I think is a very simple argument for the reliability of the Gospels, and particularly for Luke, is just the what's right at the very centre of Luke, which is the thing focusing on Jesus dying and rising again. And here we've got a second century bit of graffiti. It's a man on the cross with his bottom facing towards you, and underneath it says, "Alexamenus worships God." And it's not a man, it's a donkey. Because that was the way people viewed crucifixion back then. The idea that you would worship someone being crucified is as stupid as worshipping a donkey, which is the most proverbially stupid animal. That was how the crucifixion was perceived. Romans showing that they're in charge. Anyone who's crucified is a loser. So how does it really get started? How does the Christian message get started without something like the resurrection that really vindicates Jesus? When you consider what we have with Jesus, again, I'd want to come back to this idea of a network argument, that you have people worshipping him as God, you have so many miracles attributed to him, you have these stories, these parables, you have this amazing teaching such as the Golden Rule, and you have all of those together in the same person, or that same person is lucky enough to have really nice followers who are happy to pass on all their good ideas as his. And to me, when you put that all together, the most plausible, the most believable thing is that he really did say those things and that Luke reported them accurately. Thank you very much.